Shane, this morning I want to look at the book of Daniel from a critical standpoint. And as we think about looking at Daniel from this vantage point, one of the things that come to mind immediately for me is Jude's words in the third verse of the book of Jude, how that he told the Christians to whom he is writing, you know, it was his desire to write unto them concerning their common salvation, but he realized the need to have to write to them, exhorting them to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints. And so when I think about the book of Daniel from a preacher standpoint, I certainly like to simply be able to look at it homiletically. In other words, from the vantage point of how are we going to preach this thing. But unfortunately, for almost 1,800 years, there have been criticisms leveled against the book of Daniel concerning the author of the book and most importantly, the date when it was written. And these criticisms have warranted us having to, instead of just looking at the book from a homiletical standpoint, having to look at it also from a critical standpoint, from an apologetic standpoint, and being able to stand up and give a defense as to the dating of the book of Daniel. Of course, it claims to be dated in the 6th century B.C. during the days of the Babylonian Empire, but we know there are many critics who deny that date, and they like to catapult the book of Daniel to the 2nd century B.C. and like to attribute it to some sort of spurious author.
Now, what is the significance of the dating of the book? You know, we all understand that it's a biblically inspired. What difference would it make to us as believers, you know, when the book was written?
That's a good question. Dr. David M. Valletta of the University of Colorado writes an article called The Book of Daniel and Recent Research. And one of the things that he does in this article is quote from another professor by the name of E.C. Lucas and from his commentary on the Book of Daniel. And one thing that he quotes is how that Lucas says in his commentary, again from 2002 on the Book of Daniel, he says he maintains that there are plausible arguments for either a 6th or a 2nd century BCE date for the book, and that this issue does not materially affect the belief in divine inspiration or the authority of the book. Now, we vehemently deny that statement. We don't confirm that affirmation. We do believe that if the book of Daniel claims to have been written in the 6th century, but it's not written until the 2nd century, then that presents a problem in regards to the integrity of the book, which therefore also presents a problem in regards to the claim of inspiration. Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse number 16, that all scripture is given by the inspiration of God, literally God breathed, and Daniel will be included in that.
Does that include the discrepancies of, or would that imply that other books would be coming into question, you know, with the dates that they are claiming?
You bet. The book of Daniel is certainly not the only book that's in the proverbial sights of these skeptics and these critics of biblical inspiration. You look at the book of Ezekiel, you look at the book of Job, of course we look at the Pentateuch, the 5 books that were written by Moses, and all of these books in the eye of the skeptic are in question in regards to when they were written and certainly in regards to who wrote them. But the beautiful thing about it is whether we're talking about the Pentateuch, the book of Ezekiel, the book of Job, or whatever book of the Bible we're talking about, the evidence has shown forth that these books were written exactly when they claimed to have been written. One of the arguments that was leveled against the 5 books of the Pentateuch and the Mosaic authorship of those books was, well, there was certainly no way that in 1500 B.C. that there could have been a law such as the law of Moses that was that particular, that meticulous, that detailed, and that advanced at that particular time. And of course, later on, they found the Code of Hammurabi, which dated to 1700 B.C. That's 200 years before the books of Moses even claimed to be written. And they found this Code of Hammurabi also contained a very meticulous and advanced system of law. And so that kind of blows that argument right out of the water that Moses could not have written the Pentateuch because of the advanced system of law that we find therein.
We'll take a look at Daniel. Can we get into some specifics as to the arguments and see if they have any validity to their argument to source the date of the book of Daniel itself?
You bet. The main premise of their argument, from what I understand, is that the predictive prophecy of the book of Daniel is so detailed, is so accurate, as Daniel begins to envisions his own visions and those of Nebuchadnezzar that he interprets in Daniel chapter 2. In these visions, we find a unfolding of the events of what we would now refer to as world history, empires that would succeed other empires. And when we look at this from retrospectively, we find out that everything that Daniel said was going to take place is exactly what took place. The Babylonian Empire, of course, is in power when Daniel was writing. Nebuchadnezzar is its king, at least its first king that we're dealing with there. When they begin to see these visions, for instance, in Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar in his dream sees this vision of this colossal figure with a head of gold, with chest and arms of silver, stomach and thighs of bronze, legs and feet, partly of iron, partly of potter's clay. Whenever Daniel and his friends are able to give the interpretation of this dream, first of all, to reveal this dream and then give the interpretation of it, what Daniel says is that, Nebuchadnezzar, you are this head of gold. You're a great king, a king of kings. In fact, God has given you dominion and glory and power. He says, but after you, there's going to come another kingdom inferior to yours. And later on in the book of Daniel, in chapter 8, it identifies that second kingdom as the Medo-Persian Empire. Of course, historically, we look at the records and we find that that's certainly the case. The Medo-Persian Empire succeeded that of the Babylonians. And then, of course, he sees in this third element of this colossal figure that there would be a third empire, and this one would be Greece. And again, in Daniel chapter 8, Greece is mentioned by name as a successor to the Medo-Persian Empire. Well, we look back in history, and that's certainly been the case. And so on. Of course, we know the fourth empire being that of Rome, and historically that's certainly unfolded in that fashion. And so people look at the predictive prophecy of Daniel, not only these empires unfolding, but some details in regards to specific kings that come out of these empires, most notably Antiochus Epiphanes. And they say there's certainly no way this thing could have been written in the 6th century as it claimed to be.
Well, specifically with the book of Daniel, mm-hmm. It's the source of one of the oldest arguments against the Bible itself. I believe in the 3rd century, there was an argument alleging that the dates of the book itself were in question.
Right.
Why do you suppose this is a continuing effort to discredit this particular book?
Yeah, what you're talking about, Brother Shane, is around 280 A.D., there was a Neoplatonist by the name of Porphyry. He was a Phoenician philosopher. And he was one of the first that I can find in history that would level an attack against the book of Daniel in regards to its dating. One of the things that Porphyry would say, well, just let me read a quote. And this quote comes from Jerome and his commentary on Daniel as he is summarizing Porphyry's position in a document that Porphyry wrote called Against the Christians. And of course, what Jerome is doing is defending the validity of Daniel against the claims and the charges and allegations of Porphyry. But Porphyry wrote in his 12th book against the prophecy of Daniel, denying that it was composed by the person to whom it is described in its title, but rather by some individual living in Judea at the time of Antiochus, who was surnamed Epiphanes. He furthermore alleged, and this is Jerome writing, he furthermore alleged that Daniel did not foretell of the future so much as he related the past. And lastly, whatever he spoke of up until the time of Antiochus contained authentic history, whereas anything he may have conjectured beyond that point was false, inasmuch as he would have not have foreknown the future. And so the last thing that Jerome writes, quoting from Porphyry, is really the key to it all. Porphyry denied, and critics, modern-day critics, and there are many of whom we'll talk about a few in just a moment, they deny this man's ability to have known the future. And what they're actually denying is the phenomena of supernatural revelation. I've got a theory on that, Shane, and you can weigh in and let me know if you agree or disagree. But my theory on why there are so many men that deny divine inspiration is because if we actually admit that these words come from God, I'm talking about our Bibles, this divine revelation that we know as our Bibles, if we admit that this thing actually come from God, if we weigh the evidence and we draw the conclusion that's warranted by the evidence, which that conclusion would be that this did come from God, then then that holds us accountable to it. That makes us amenable to its dictates, to its statutes. That holds us, again, accountable to it.
I'm in 100% agreement with that, brother. 100% agreement. We as men, you know, we don't like to consider ourselves to be accountable to anyone. You know, we like to think that our outcome is predicted upon ourselves, you know.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is there's one that has created us for a purpose. And with that understanding comes the responsibility to acknowledge that God has created us, and it is us who owe him our lives and things of that nature. We are to worship and praise him. And if we can deny that, then we have no reason for the structured life that we have right now.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. We don't have to worry about if we deny the inspiration of the Bible and if those denials could be rendered legitimate, which again, we emphasize emphatically that they cannot. But if those denials can be rendered legitimate, denials of the inspiration of the Bible, the divine inspiration of the Bible, then I don't have to worry about what 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse number 10 teaches, how that one day every last one of us will stand before the judgment seat of Christ to give an account of the things that we've done in this body. We will be rewarded according to what we have done, Paul emphasizes, whether that be good or bad. And so I don't have to worry about that if this book doesn't really come from God. I can simply dismiss that as a false claim, and I can live the way that I want to live.
What do you think about, you know, I believe that some individuals will have the defense that, you know, I believe what I believe, and it's something that you have to step out on faith with. Now, not everything can be proven, you know, therefore, as, you know, we believe in God, it's not something that a person can see, right? We know God is a spirit, mm-hmm. and as long as I feel God is a presence in my life and whatnot, then that's why I believe what I believe.
Well, let's take that thought, Shane, and let's apply it to the book of Daniel, since we're dealing with the book of Daniel this morning. One of the things that scoffers like to do is they like to say, well, hey, the book of Daniel, you know, there's no way that it could have been inspired, no way that it could have been written when it was written. They don't necessarily say we hold that position by faith. They try to actually present arguments that they deem legitimate in regards to that, but the thing that I want to emphasize again is these arguments have been refuted and thoroughly debunked time and again. And so something I like to do whenever I'm teaching on the book of Daniel or other books like this, and especially from a critical standpoint, I like to emphasize that, Shane, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We're not going to come up with any apologetics that are all brand new, that haven't been dealt with before. As you said, we've already just quoted from Jerome, and Jerome did a very satisfactory job of debunking the criticisms of Porphyry. We look at the fact that there were critics like S.R. Driver of the 19th century, late 19th century. He published a commentary on the book of Daniel. As a matter of fact, the first publishing was in 1900. And S.R. Driver is probably one of the ripest critics of the book of Daniel that has ever existed. Rivaled probably by none other than Porphyry himself. But S.R. Driver, one of the things that he presents by way of trying to disprove a 6th century dating of the book of Daniel is the fact that there are some Greek words in the book of Daniel. You'll remember in the book how that it's in the third chapter, the companions of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names, we know them better and more affectionately as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These men were leaders of the province of Babylon at that time. The Bible teaches us that Nebuchadnezzar had built a 90-foot statue, an image, or an idol, and he set it up in the plain of Dura. He commanded that all of the people, whenever they heard a number of instruments play together, that they were to bow down and to worship this idol. And when you look at those instruments as they are being listed in the third chapter of the book of Daniel, you'll find that out of the ones that are listed, there are three of them that have Greek names. Right? They're called by Greek names in the book of Daniel. Well, S.R. Driver's argumentation goes something like this. There is certainly no way in the 6th century B.C. that Imperial Babylon, that their dialect would have contained words from Greece. Their vernacular would not have contained words from Greece. And of course, the premise is this, that the Greeks didn't rise to power until 331 BC. And the process of Hellenization, that is trying to make the entire world Greek, under Alexander the Great, didn't begin until the 4th century, about the middle to the end of the 4th century BC. And so these people in Imperial Babylon and the Neo-Babylonian Empire simply would not have utilized Greek words. But the fact of the matter is this. We look back at the writings, the history of the father of history, the Greek historian Herodotus. Herodotus himself tells us that there was interaction between the Greeks and the Babylonians a long time prior to the 6th century. And so that certainly makes sense to us, does it not?
It does, it does. And one of the things you mentioned is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel, and that's a good point for myself, you know, because I'm not a history buff, you know, so it prompts me to understand that there's a way that we can prepare ourselves as Christians to defend the gospel. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with just researching the history on a particular topic. You know, like I said, as you mentioned, there's names of individuals that have already put up valid evidence and arguments mm-hmm. that counter what the proposed illegitimate arguments, you know, are put out there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I encourage everybody to be students of history. It's one thing that I've always affirmed, whether you're talking about the discipline of science or history, archaeology, astronomy, whatever the case may be, whenever these disciplines, respectively, are honest, whenever they are being portrayed legitimately, with integrity, then they'll never contradict the Bible. They'll never contradict the Bible. True history does not contradict the Bible, but it will always coincide with it. True science, contrary to popular belief, will not contradict the Bible, but it'll always stand in harmony with the Scriptures. The Scriptures are from God, and God is in the business of telling the truth. All His ways are truth, His words are truth. In John chapter 17, verse number 17, you'll recall how that Jesus Christ, on the night in which He was betrayed, prayed on behalf of His apostles, and He prayed to the Father, "Father, sanctify them through Thy truth. Thy word is truth." And so, Brother Michael Shepherd, Pensacola, Florida, always says in his sermons that truth runs in parallel lines. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. Certainly concur with that thought. Truth always runs in parallel lines. So whether it's truth of science, whether it's truth of history, whether it's truth of the various disciplines within science, astronomy, oceanography, archaeology, it's going to coincide with the Bible if that science is true.
You brought up the point dealing with the specific language that was used in Daniel and allegation that those particular words were not available to Daniel in the 6th century BC. Mm-hmm. Is there evidence that contradicts that claim, that allegation?
Exactly. As we've already mentioned, Herodotus, who is often deemed the father of history, we know there are historians that come along later on, like Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, who are familiar with these guys, Philo. These are guys who were known for their histories. But Herodotus wrote in about the middle of the 5th century B.C. He's known as the father of histories. And he tells us very specifically in his writings that there was interaction between the Greeks and the people of the East long before the 6th century. Also, concerning the languages of Daniel, Robert Vassholes, in a study published in the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society in 1978, accurately affirmed, as far as Greek loanwords are concerned, an insinuation that their appearance demands a date posterior to Alexander the Great is now absurd. An avalanche of evidence has demonstrated the presence of Greek language in the Semitic Malu long before the 6th century B.C. And so here it is. Here we have another scholar who comes along and says, hey, there were Greek words being utilized in Eastern vernacular long before the 6th century. And again, as we've already mentioned, it simply makes sense to offer up the position that there would have been no Greek terminology utilized in Middle Eastern languages, or vice versa, is simply the state of position that I believe is gullible or naive. What you're actually assuming is that there was no interaction between the East and the West, between Eastern Europe and Western Asia prior to the 2nd century BC. And that's just an idea, just preposterous. That's a concept that is absurd. We know that there was interaction between continents, between civilizations, between countries and nations, as early as there was differences in these civilizations.
One of the things that I've come to realize in the study of this of the Book of Daniel is just the denial of God himself is so prevalent in some of these individuals' claims against the Book of Daniel. And you see that apparently when evidence is presented, you know, even as these individuals that have opposing views see evidence, there's rarely a retraction that's right. done. So at what point will an individual come to know the truth and be honest with themselves and bring that retraction about? Because there's a lot of effort put into right. denying the book.
Yes, sir. I think your key word there, Shane, is honesty. That's your key word. Even when we look at Jesus Christ as he was teaching the parable of the sower and the different types of soil, and we find this parable recorded for us in the book of Matthew, as recorded in the book of Luke as well, in Luke's account, one thing that he mentions is whenever that seed falls on that fourth type of soil that he mentioned, the soil, of course, represent the various types of or conditions of the hearts of men. He mentions that fourth soil is that good heart, that whenever that seed is planted, it will germinate, bring forth fruit up to 100-fold. One of the factors, one of the catalysts in that seed bringing forth fruit when it falls upon that soil of that good heart is, he says, that heart was honest. Luke mentions the fact that whenever that seed falls upon a good and honest heart, then it's going to germinate, bring forth fruit. And so that's the key term, Shane, is honesty. Is honesty. You know, at the end of the day, we got to put aside our presumptions, our presuppositions. We've got to put aside our preconceived notions and ideas and be open and honest enough simply to receive the truth whenever we see it unfolded through the evidence that's available to us. And the fact of the matter is, a sad fact of the matter, is a lot of people are just not that honest. They have no intentions of being that honest. A lot of people, they make it their point, and especially in the realm of academia, make it their point simply to try to overturn anything that is godly and righteous whatsoever. Friends, we see that in the country in which we live, very devastating way this particular time. But at this point, Shane, we need to wrap up our study. And of course, when you look at this subject matter, we could go on really for hours and hours on it. We've just simply touched the hem of the garment, if we've even done that, and looking at Daniel from a critical standpoint and looking at the host and the multitude of scoffers and critics who have tried to level charges against the book of Daniel, claiming that it could not have been written in the 6th century when it claims to have been written. And of course, what we hope is that our listening audience will join us again. We'll visit this topic again. We'll try to delve a little bit deeper into it. And hopefully on next time, be able to present some more of the criticisms against the 6th century dating of the book of Daniel, his authorship of the book, and also present some more refutation, some more sound refutation of those criticisms. To the only wise God and our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever.
Grace be with all them that love our Lord Jesus Christ in sincerity.